Welcome to Hebrew Bible Insights, a podcast about making sense of the Hebrew Bible. We engage in the study of the Hebrew Bible in its ancient Near Eastern context and original languages to promote good and reasonable interpretation of Scripture so that the church might live more faithfully in the present. Welcome to Hebrew Bible Insights, a podcast about making sense of the Hebrew Bible. I'm Matthew Delaney with my co-host, Dr. Nathan French, and we are very excited for our guest today. We have Dr. Kevin Grasso, and he has a PhD in Hebrew language from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem in Israel. What an amazing PhD.
Fantastic.
And he is the co-founder and CEO of BibLingo. It is one of the absolute best ways to learn and master the biblical languages through technology. And he's also the host for the Biblical Language Podcast, which is an excellent place to have a good dosage of language content in your ears as you're driving, working out, and doing the dishes. So, Kevin, thank you so much for joining the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So before we dive in, I give a brief intro, but in case people aren't familiar with you, your content, tell us, how did you get interested in biblical languages? Why did you choose to commit yourself to this passion in your life?
Yeah, so it really began with some sort of more theological questions that I had. And I recognized as I was digging into issues that a lot of the arguments that were being made were really just based on what Hebrew and Greek words meant. And so that made me realize that I really need to know what these words mean if I'm going to engage in these more, you know, controversial topics or even just like important topics for everyday living as Christians. So I then started studying the biblical languages, and then I realized that I actually need a theory on how words mean what they mean, right? Because you could look up a word in a lexicon or a dictionary, and you could see, oh, it has this many different meanings. But then how do I decide which meaning is the right one in this context and why, and what are the implications, and et cetera, et cetera. But for that, you have to figure out, you know, why one word would mean both X and Y, and what it might mean, or why it might mean something like X in a certain context and Y in another context. And we can get into, you know, more of these details, but basically that's the reason why I got into it in the first place.
That's so cool. I'd recommend anyone listening to check out, I believe it was January 2023, you posted a YouTube video on your BibLingo YouTube page explaining the Shema and how do we understand what the word Echad means in this famous verse. And that's a great case study of how do you figure out what words mean in their context. Again, we'll get to that question later on in this conversation. But first, I have another question for you, because you've done something that I would say is not a typical path into the broad field of biblical studies. I think let's say if you got a master's degree in biblical languages, that might have been more normal, but you got one in linguistics specifically. I don't run into that very often. Can you maybe help us understand what's the difference between the doing a master's degree in biblical languages as opposed to linguistics, and how did that form and shape you in terms of your research and what you do?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess to add to that as well, I mean, my PhD is basically in linguistics. I mean, at Hebrew University, basically, if you're in the Hebrew language department, you can kind of straddle the Bible department in Hebrew, or you can straddle the linguistics department in Hebrew. And I was the linguistics side. All my classes were linguistic theory based. But it's applied to Hebrew. So, yeah, I mean, I think one of the things within biblical studies now that people are recognizing more and more is that we have been dealing with a lot of questions, the same questions for a very long time. And the way to attack those questions is to look at it through a new lens, right? And so people are beginning to apply all kinds of different hermeneutics to the text. They've been doing it for quite some time. But my sort of thinking was that if I figure out what syntax is or semantics is before I look at what Hebrew semantics or syntax is or Greek, then I can have a better understanding on just how I can evaluate the theories that are out there, right? So I did I went completely backwards. So I basically, I did a master's in linguistics. I did a PhD in Hebrew, which is basically linguistics. And then I just finished a master's in, or I'm just finishing a master's in comparative religion as well from Hebrew University, where I'm just, basically doing Second Temple Judaism and New Testament stuff. But the idea was, if I can provide, or if I can give myself a solid foundation on language in general, then I can approach Hebrew and Greek from a more informed language perspective. And then that will give me the foundation I need to answer the grammatical questions, which are based on, or we know which the theological questions are based on.
Well, the world is grateful that you chose this path. I love how committed you are to language. Yes. And it's so cool. One of my, I have a random interest in just the ancient world, ancient history, ancient languages. One of my favorite scholars who's in a non-biblical related field, he took the same path you did with Old Norse. He took an MA in linguistics, and then his PhD was also in Norse linguistics. So we need more people in this field. As you say, the trend is moving more in this direction to be more holistic in our exegesis. So I'm really glad that you took this path.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Kevin, thanks for coming on. It's great to have you. So on that note, I want to ask this particular question. So within linguistics, what areas have been most interesting to you for research and for teaching? So maybe unpack that just a bit more, maybe.
Yeah. So, for me, I've always been interested in just like, what does the text mean, right? Mm-hmm. And for that, really the field of semantics, first and foremost, is the subfield within linguistics that is most relevant. So semantics deals with meaning. Now, there are really three related fields. So the first one you might say is pragmatics. So pragmatics deals with meaning as well, but it doesn't deal with, usually the difference is truth conditional meaning versus non-truth conditional meaning, which I would have to explain. But you basically, as an illustration, you can think of something like a simple sentence, like, can I pass the salt? Or sorry, can I have the salt? Right? Can you pass the salt? And so when you say that semantically means something, right? Do you have the ability to, give me the salt, right? Pragmatically, it means something different, right? I'm making a request. Like, I'm not asking you if you have an ability. So that semantic meaning is always there. I can say something like, can my 2-year-old pass the salt? And that is a legitimate question. Does he have the ability to do that? It depends on the moment, Yeah. But usually the pragmatic meaning is more to the fore there. But basically, that's just a very real world illustration of the difference. Uh-huh. Between the two. And then syntax is, has to do with the order of constituents in a sentence. So, again, some of the questions in English, for example, have inverted word order. Can you pass the salt? You move the verb to the front, can, versus you can pass the salt, right? And then, morphology. So morphology is a morpheme is just a meaningful element in language. So for example, cats has two morphemes, cat plus the plural morpheme. So my area of research has been semantics, but if you want to do semantics, you have to do all those other things, right? You have to figure out what each individual morpheme is doing, and that means figuring out what the morphemes are. You have to figure out how they're ordered, because that will affect their meaning. You have to figure out what sort of other meanings they might have. Like questions might affect, how we use language differently, right, in pragmatics. So that's, again, and even within semantics, there's two broad categories of lexical semantics versus, more formal semantics. And formal semantics is dealing with like things like plural morphemes, right? So cats, right, they're going to look at what does that plural morpheme actually mean, and surprise, it actually doesn't mean plural, because you can say zero cats, and that doesn't. In fact, it's obligatory that you say zero cats, and you can't say zero cat. So you are required to use the plural morpheme with the number zero. So anyway, those are the kinds of questions they're dealing with, What does that plural morpheme mean? And then lexical semantics deals more with like, what does the word cat mean? A lexical word that gives you some sort of content.
Fantastic. It's great. It just shows how complex language really is when you start to break it down and try to understand it, especially at these levels. All right. So on that note, I want to ask another question here with regard to Hebrew. So comparative Semitic. So how important is to understand ancient Hebrew? We know that there's different languages within the language family of Semitic. So could you tell us some about that? How has comparative Semitics helped you or been important to you in your research and understanding Hebrew?
Yeah, so it's a good question. You know, in Israel, like when you know Hebrew really well, especially for just like a Semitic language, it really does open the door to all the other Semitic languages. Mm-hmm. And there, a lot of them are very, very close. So in Israel, just, I mean, everyone kind of knows so many of them, especially this college. You know, they're just, you know, my professor, Itzer Barashir Sigal, you know, he just knows every Semitic language there is to know, right? So I think it is a necessary thing, right? It's an important, necessary thing. However, when you are approaching it linguistically, there are a number of reasons not to limit yourself to comparative Semitics, right? Yeah. And so like we would think more along the lines of like typological comparisons in general, meaning let's just look at a broad swath of languages and see what they do, right? So as an example, my advisor actually, Elliot Tsur, worked on external negation, which is like saying like, it is not the case that, you know, we are talking about French right now. So that it is not the case, right? That's called external negation. So I believe in one of the dialects of Aramaic that I'm forgetting right now, I think it's Old Babylonian, but it has a special negator that goes, that basically says like, this whole clause is negated, right? And it was argued before that didn't exist. And it was hard to make the argument from a dead language that does exist, right? Because you don't have native speaker judgments. And so it was kind of like, oh, well, maybe this is it. But there was a dialect of Italian that they discovered that actually did have this same sort of negation. And these two morphemes in these two very, very separate languages went through the same sort of path of development. And this is quite common, you know, I mean, for you know, cross languages, unrelated languages, to have a sort of like one morpheme go through the same path, and they ended up meaning the same thing, right? And so it's very helpful to look at a variety of different languages to see what they mean. So in terms of like comparative Semitics, I think sometimes it can be it's a very useful starting place for what these morphemes might mean, but you can't draw a one-to-one correlation between, you know, Hebrew and even Aramaic, for example, even though they're very, very close. So as an example, you know, I gave an SVL presentation in 2017 where I compare yiktol form in biblical Hebrew, which has been called imperfective, future, modal, irialis, whatever, all the names you can think of. And I just compare it to three other forms. And it is most like this chiardial potential form. Basically, it has all the uses except for one. And so it's like almost identical to this other form. And so, you know, that tells us, right, that whatever that thing is doing, yiktol is doing as well. Right. So that's the real value of comparing across languages to see, okay, because especially within Hebrew grammatical studies, you can get in your own sort of like silo, like scholarly silo. Right? And you say, oh, it means this, it means that. But if you don't look outside and see what other languages are doing, it's very easy to just to miss what is obviously happening in these other languages that are living languages, right? That we can verify. Yeah. So I think that's the real value in typological comparisons in general.
Okay. Yeah, very good. Just maybe a quick follow-up question on that. So how about for semantics, though, in general? Like, is there any sense in which the relation of roots within the Semitic languages can bring meaning one way or the other and give us insight into what maybe a text means or doesn't mean? Have you found that maybe in your research at all? Or yeah,
For sure. So again, I think within comparative Semitics, like the root is So first of all, every language has roots, right? So that I think what's special about the Semitic languages is that the roots are easier to see, right, or hear. Yes. So the idea that the root in Semitic languages is very transparent absolutely gives you a starting place. What it does is it gives you a starting place for the lexicon, right, for lexical semantics. So if you don't know what a word means, right, you can say, okay, well, do we find this root anywhere else? And that will help us to figure out, to have a starting place for what that word means. At the same time, you have to be careful because, again, if you find the same root in Aramaic, it does not mean it means the same thing, right? Right. So it usually has some sort of related meaning, but not the same, right? As an example, I actually got the chance to go to Sweden to study Syriac. This is kind of a crazy thing. I was there for 3 weeks, and I was with all these Syrians in Sweden, just speaking Syriac all the time.
That's great. Amazing.
But we would have, you know, our meals as much as we could in Syriac, and I would say meshko for butter, right? And if you hear that, right, it might sound like mashach or mashiach, right? It's the same root, but they wouldn't say butter, you know, for meshko, right? In Hebrew, right?
Right?
But you can see how. Anointing,
yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. There is a connection there. Oil, yeah. Anointing, butter, mm-hmm. Right? But it's not the same, right? So again, it's a starting place, but you just have to be careful.
Excellent. Good. I mean, I think that shows how important context really becomes in this whole discussion. So, yeah, very good.
You know, as you talk, I think about the old adage that you don't know one language until you know two. And linguistics is almost like, let me go ahead and not just one-up you, but many-up you by learning how many languages work. And I think probably the most important point that people don't realize the uniqueness of linguistics specifically is if you do just ancient languages, you're staying with only ancient languages. Mm-hmm. But if we think, hey, we're all still humans, whether we lived a few thousand years ago or today, how do languages just work? How do people communicate? And with things we have more certainty about the present, how can that be applied to the past? Very nuanced work though. That's deep research and very interesting. So, this next part of our conversation, we're going to ask you just a few questions about a couple areas, a couple subfields within linguistics, just to kind of get a taste, a sample of what this looks like. I know semantics is your particular passion, but I first want to ask you a question about syntax. And particularly within ancient Hebrew, there's a debate, substantive debate going on. What is the word order in ancient Hebrew? And ultimately, this impacts how we read text because we want to look at what ends up being marked, what ends up being something is not as different from the norm. Can you maybe speak to the idea of word order in biblical Hebrew and maybe give an example of how that might impact exegesis?
Yeah. So just to preface, you really can't do good semantics without syntax. So I introduce them all together because they're all related. That being said, semantics is my main field. But I'll illustrate this with some examples on why you need to do semantics and syntax together. But basically, the debate, let me just give you a lay of the land first, and then I'll kind of give you my thoughts. So a lot of the debate is about whether biblical Hebrew is what's called an SVO, you know, basic word order, or VSO, basic word order. So what that means is if a word order is basic, it means that it doesn't have any sort of like special meaning in that order. Okay. So the difference, right, would be, you know, Moshe halach el hamidbar, or that's not a good example, actually. Lekach, you know, Moshe lekach, you know, et asal, right? So Moses took the basket, right? So would you say it like Moshe lakach or lakach Moshe? Okay, so that's the basic question that we're asking. And the idea is that if you have VSO basic order, then whenever you have SVO, so Moshe lakach et asal, then you would have some sort of special meaning with Moshe, okay? if the basic order is SVO, then the order Lekach Moshe Etz HaSal would be special in some way, right? You have some sort of special meaning with the verb Lekach. So the reason why this affects the way we read the Bible is because in every single, you know, clause, we have to figure out, okay, what's the order? And is there some sort of special meaning because it is ordered in that way? So that is the sort of like basic question in the field.
So yeah, this is obviously huge, and it impacts a lot of things in this space. I don't know if there's an example you want to give, or we can go to the next topic within linguistics.
Oh no, yeah, yeah. So let me just. Well, that's the conversation, right? So I have a lot of opinions about the conversation. So
sure, yeah, give your opinions. Where do you stand? Obviously, we should say, by the way, give a quick plug before I forget. You have an 8-part series in your podcast. You probably spend about 8 hours or so discussing this in depth. So if people want more content, go to your podcast, but maybe give us the nutshell version.
Yeah, yeah. So to be fair, some of those are on Greek. So, you know, if you're a Greek person, you can go to that as well, but it's not all Hebrew. But yeah, so I start off talking with Paul Krager, who is just a linguist, doesn't know Hebrew. He was actually my MA advisor, but he's a syntactician. And so what we discuss is what basic word order actually is, right? And so this is really one of the fundamental issues with the field right now is figuring out what are we going to count, right, as a basic clause to begin with, right? And so this is part of the problem is, you know, one of the big debates is, do we count vayikol clauses, for example, right? So if you know Hebrew, you know that vayikol, you know, is always going to be first. And it's also the most common form, especially in narrative. So then what's going to happen is if you're just going to count clauses, you're going to see, oh, VSO, it's way, way more common than SVO. And so then you might conclude, right, based on frequency, that VSO is the basic order. So there are a number of reasons why that's just not the way we do syntax. So first of all, it is vayikol is like known to be marked because it is in a syntactically special slot. We know that because it doesn't ever co-occur with a share or key. It is never subordinated, right? So what that means is, like, again, from a syntax perspective, like if you were to, you know, ask any syntactician what that means, it means that they're in the same slot, right? The reason why a share or key cannot co-occur with vayikol is because vayikol is already there, right? Mm. So the fact that katal or yiktol can tells us that it's in a different slot, right? So what that means is that a better way to frame this whole question is, okay, what does it look like for a katal form to be marked, right? What does it look like for a yiktol form? What does it look like for a vayikol, right? We can talk about, you know, okay, what the language is, you know, whether it's VSO or SVO, but that's not actually that helpful, right? What's helpful is when I encounter a verbal form in the text, how do I know if it has a special meaning or not, right? And the fact that we know vayikol to be in a different syntactic slot than katal or yiktol, and same goes with vekatal, we know that it has to be analyzed differently, right? So, you know, there are, again, a number of scholars debating this. I would take the position that, you know, with katal and yiktol, SVO is unmarked, right? So it's not, so even that being said, like you have to say it carefully. So it is not the case that the subjects in SVO order are never marked. It is the case that they are not necessarily marked, right? So when you, as an example, right, we can look at Genesis 36:2, right? So this is, there was a debate going on between Robert Holmsted, who was really the big proponent, early proponent, him and Vince DeCain, on SVO order, and Aaron Hornkall. So Aaron Hornkall wrote a response article to, actually Holmsted's response article to Moshavi and some others in the field that were claiming VSO order. So basically, Homestead analyzed every clause within Genesis and said, hey, look, there's more SVO unmarked clauses than VSO. And Horncall comes up and says, hey, actually, you counted wrong. And there's actually more VSO unmarked clauses. And I think the counts don't matter, right? like if I found one instance of a marked, Catal form with SVO, right? Then I would have to take that into my theory, right? I'm not just counting clauses and seeing which one's more frequent, right? So I'm trying to figure out in each instance, what is the meaning of these elements, right? And does the word order affect those? Okay. So in Genesis, 36:2, Esav lakach et nashav mibnot Kanaan, right? Esau took the women, from the daughters of Cain. Okay. Or his women, his wives. So here we have a SVO sentence, right? Esav lakach, right? Et nashav. So what's really important about this debate and what has not been recognized enough is that you need all of those elements, right? So you need an object. It does not count. In linguistics, it does not count if you don't have an object. And the reason is because we know that it affects word order sometimes in some languages, right? If you don't have an object. It doesn't count if your object is a pronoun. We know that that affects word order. And so there are all of these things that need to be taken into consideration that honestly are not being taken into consideration nearly enough, right? And These are semantic considerations, right? We know, for example, that the kind of verb will affect your word order sometimes. So as an example, passives, right? Passives are known to like VSO order more, or VS order, right? And the reason is because the subject in a passive sentence is the object in an active sentence. So it makes sense that the if you have SVO order, right, and the what was originally an object came after the verb, once you delete the subject you have VO, right, and the O becomes S, right? So it makes total sense that you would do that, and we see that in Hebrew, right? And I could go on and on, so I won't go through these examples, but the whole point is that people have to be way, way more careful about the meaning of words, actually semantics, and how that might affect the syntax before they conclude, for example, from this text that Esau is focused or topicalized in some way, right? It's just and those are the terms that are used for this sort of special meaning, but basically because people don't know semantics well enough, or shouldn't say it that way, because people don't take into account semantics as much as they should, they end up forcing readings into text, right? Mm-hmm. And because there are no native speakers, there is no way to say you're actually wrong. Like, there is no marked meaning here, because you can just make up a story about how this is a special meaning because of the word order, and it's all it can all be based on your theory that might not actually be correct.
Yeah, that's so good. It's interesting too, because what you're really doing here is you're lifting up the ancient person, right? The ancient writer in this particular sense. You're saying, look, what they've written and how they've written it really matters for how we are to first understand it and interpret it before we, make our claims that this is what it means. We must first do this very serious and very difficult work so that the ancient person can be validated in what they've actually passed down to us. So I think that's an excellent, excellent point that you're making. So go ahead.
One more thought before we go to the next question, though. I think what's important people hear is what's happening is multiple factor research, where I think people, we can have a lot of intellectual discussions and someone brings up, here's one stat, but we don't realize this stat is based on a single factor. Where what you're talking about is it's not a simple matter of let's count every sentence in the Hebrew Bible and which one has more verbs or subjects first. It's looking at, like you said, is there a direct object in the clause or not? Or what's the literary genre? And so there are a number of factors you look into. And this is the value of having experts and professionals who are doing this deep research.
Yeah. No, that's yeah.
And I think this is part of the issue within, like, the people who are doing linguistics in biblical Hebrew studies is a lot of them are coming at it really not with a degree in linguistics, right? I mean, I think this is because what a degree gets you, I mean, of course, it doesn't, this isn't always the case, but what a degree often will get you is sort of like broad spectrum of, like, you know, I took a class on syntax and semantics and morphology, and, you know, I had to do all those things, right? And so you kind of can begin to understand how they're all related, right? And that's where this sort of integrative approach, it has to become more common, because you, you just can't, I mean, and good linguists know this, you can't do syntax without semantics, or vice versa, or even pragmatics, or even morphology, right? Everyone recognizes that these three, these four, you know, subfields are interrelated.
Yeah, that's great. So, okay, on that note then, so a lot of times when we're teaching students biblical Hebrew or any of the biblical languages for that matter, we often take them to a lexicon, right? And the lexicon gives us meanings of words that can help them to try to translate what they're looking at. So maybe talk to us some about this. How do we, you already have, I mean, on quite a level, but let's unpack, I guess, the relation to the lexicon and what we should know about what lexicons are and what they are not and how they can help us. So how can we know what a word means beyond looking at the sort of a word meaning and a one-to-one ratio that we find in the lexicon?
Yeah. So I, you know, as you get better and better at Hebrew, you will recognize that lexicons are, they're good starting places. So like, that's all they are. Right.
Yeah.
And it's really the same thing with comparative semantics. It's like, okay, I understand this is your idea about what the word means. And I will now look at the data and come up with my own idea. Right. And that's really what you need to do to, you know, have, I mean, honestly, that's why you should want to learn Hebrew. You don't want to learn Hebrew so that you can gloss everything the same way as a lexicon, right?
Yeah.
You want to learn Hebrew so that you can have some sort of insight that you didn't have previously, right?
Yeah.
And like, people doing your translations, they know what's in the lexicon, right? And they're glossing as per the lexicon, right? and so like, what you want to be able to do is you know, decide for yourself what a word means and why, right? So I'll give an example from my dissertation. So I focused on verbs of judgment. So, you know, there's a lot of controversy about these words. So I did one chapter, for example, on shafat, and, you know, the sorts of related words to that root. And this is, you know, if you know the book of Judges, right? It's shoftim. And this is how the word is normally translated in a lexicon. So people have recognized, though, that it doesn't always fit well. And actually, if you look at the Oxford English Dictionary, which is the most comprehensive English dictionary ever, it has a sense for judge. And it says that it's only when translated from the Bible, it doesn't mean to rule. So that begs the question, it's like, what if that translation is just wrong, right? Like, that's just a bad translation. Yeah. If it only means, you know, if this English word only means this in a translation from a particular text, then you should have just chosen a different English word, right? So we see this, it's very common, right? This meaning of to rule over some people or area. So I said, okay, well, how do we decide, right? What this word means? Does it mean to rule? Does it mean to judge? And really, my argument is that words are, so I'm talking about like lexical words here, disambiguated based on syntax. Okay, so what that means is that I can look at syntax to help me figure out what a word means in context. Okay, so when people thought like context as a way to determine meaning, right? This is how we determine meaning, like intuitively. We just get it. If I said I'm going to run to the store, you will normally mean think that I'm going to drive there, right? If I'm going to run to my friend's house, that's right down the road, right? You will think that I'm actually going to run there. If my nose is running, then it means something very different, right? And so the kind of argument that a verb takes, like my nose, right? Or to the store, right? Or you know, to my friend's house, that's right down the road, will affect how we interpret those words, okay? So so when I say the word argument, the verbs in particular take words that complete the thought of the verb. So run, someone has to be running, right? Or something, okay? So my research was, okay, how can we determine, if we have all these different senses of shafat, how can we determine what sense is activated? Like, is there some sort of thing in the context that can help us figure that out, right? And so basically the answer is yes, right? That you can figure out what sense is activated in each context if you pay careful attention to the arguments that are associated with each verb. So for example, I listed at least like four senses for shafat, right? Make a ruling, decide between two people that are arguing, rule over an area, and deliver or punish, which is really the same thing. It's just a different, I know it sounds very different, but it's just to execute a ruling, basically. And that could be positive or negative. So with make a ruling, you have a single rulee. So you can see this in Leviticus 19:15, Ishbot Amitecha, right? To decide between two parties, you have to have the prepositional complement, et or im. You can see that in Exodus 18:16. To rule over an area, you see this, again, a lot in the book of Judges, but it's always with a plural or collective object. So my point is that that's not accident, right? It that is the reason why that's the case is because what you're actually saying is, like, kind of a paraphrase, is this person has the authority to make rulings over all these different people, right? And so a plural object basically creates this sort of like dispositional reading, this state that holds, and so it's just says this person has the authority to make rulings, right, over this group. And then finally you have you know, the sort of deliver or punish reading, for example, 2 Samuel 18:19. And this is when the result state is modified. So, you know, I think the line is, you know, Shepato Adonai Miyad Oyavo, right? And so it's talking about David, you know, Adonai has delivered him from the hand of his enemies. And so this Miyad Oyavo, right, is giving us a result state, and it forces this interpretation of deliver, right? Mm. So in all of these cases, the point is that there are things in the syntax, that specific things that we can point to, right, that lead us to interpret it in this way. So when you look at the lexicon and say, oh, okay, there's like, how many different meanings of this word? How do I figure out which one to choose in which context, right? Well, there's actually a reason why each of those senses is activated, right? You figure out the reason. And then when you come to a novel context, you say, okay, what do I have here, right? And that can help you not just to, you know, again, it helps you to figure out what words mean in specific context, which is really what we want, right? When we're doing it, we want to figure out what it means here, right? Yeah. And to engage in those kinds of debates.
You know, I'll give a quick plug for Biblingo here. One of the things you guys do with vocabulary is give number of senses. If someone clicks on the word when they're reading, again, it doesn't tell them which sense they should choose or which one's right. Again, that requires a lot more technical work, but at least helps you realize when people start learning a language, it's often, here's a word, here's what it means. You know, you will find some that will give a slew of meanings, but hopefully this conversation helps people understand how do we go about determining meaning and what does it mean to read something in context in a very educated way.
Well,
let's talk
about one thing really quick about that.
Please.
I think it's also just really important that people are just reflective on their own language, right? Because it would just help people to understand, like, these are really complex things. So, you know, my car can break down, right? If you just like look up the word break, and then someone can break into my house, and I can break up with someone, and, you know, I mean, there's just my face can break out, right? I mean, it's just like all of these different senses.
And then we're broke, right? We're broke.
We're broke, so. Right?
Yeah.
And the entire time, like, there's nothing that's actually broken, right? You know, and so it's very complex. And if people would start to think more about English in this way, I think it will go a long way to when you approach Hebrew, you say, okay, I should have a little bit more humility with these kinds of things, right? Because the reality is it's still very, very little, you know, compared to a native speaker.
Yeah,
there it is. And that's the voice of the linguistics master right there, right? let us linguistics together, right? So let's talk about one more area within linguistics, which is discourse analysis. This is becoming very interesting to me. I would love to hear some of your thoughts on discourse analysis. And I also have a very niche question for you too, which is also, what's the largest unit of language that we would consider is still under discourse analysis, or is something at some point too big that it then moves into another category? So it's kind of a niche tag along question that I have for you along with that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this is actually the problem with discourse analysis is that I often ask people, well, what is discourse analysis? Can you please like delimit it for me? Because people do it in a whole bunch of different ways. And they're what they're actually looking at is often very different. So and actually what I wrote that in my notes here is like, what is discourse? You know, like what does that mean? Right. And so I think these are, I mean, what I would say, right, is that you are, in discourse analysis, you are moving from the sentence level to anything above it, right? So in semantics, we're dealing with analysis of the, you know, the sentence. So as an example, you can just think of the word the, right? You have a meaning of the semantically, but that meaning is actually going to be affected by how, you know, like the cat, for example, how the word cat is used in other sentences in the discourse, right? So it might be in a court, right? For example, you know, a cat walked in the room, you know, and the cat was very big, right? So in this case, the is pointing back to another instance of cat, right? And it is doing something, right, in its own sentence, but it's also doing something in multiple sentences, right? And I think this is where you know, discourse analysis really, like, if we were to try to define it, it is just any sort of meaning that is like above the sentence level, right? And so what that really means is that it can be almost anything. It's kind of a way to view the text rather than you know, its own sort of, you know, like field of study. So like, for example, any sort of lexical item, I can view in the same way. I can say, okay, well, what in the discourse might activate one sense over another, right? Those are kinds of questions that would really just be in harmony with, you know, other work in semantics, and especially pragmatics that you already have to do. So I kind of view it as a separate field in that respect. So I think, in terms of like tips for helping people, language is very complex within the sentence. Once you start getting to outside of the sentence, it gets even more complex. So I think that is one just like important point for people to keep in mind. Again, it is very complex. And so what you need to be like very wary of is people making a one-to-one line from like grammar to discourse. So as an example, people say like vital is always sequential. Right. Well, what is sequentiality? Right. It is a relationship between, you know, one verb, well, one event, right? That's one verb refers to, and then the next event that another verb refers to. Okay. So that is what you're saying is that you know, in a string of vitals, each one is gonna happen in succession. Okay. That's just not the case, right? It's just not. And the issue with saying that, right, is that there are, well, the data is the issue, but there are examples where you have, you know, other kinds of relationships between one vehicle clause and another vehicle clause. And so what the point of this is from a discourse perspective, you're often looking at like tendencies, right? Rather than laws, okay? So a law in semantics might be vehicle is always past, right? Like always. and so that's what the form means, okay? But how it's used, right, is more pragmatics and discourse stuff. And that is often variable, okay? So that would be my first sort of like tip of, okay, if you're going to be dealing with discourse stuff, just be wary of any sort of claim that a discourse level feature is encoded in the grammar. Sometimes it is, right? Like the word, all sorts of like conjunctions like lachen, right, will necessarily make reference to other sentences. But it is very, you just need to be very careful with that. So does that kind of answer your question?
Sure. Yeah, but it's basically it's the connection between sentences is ultimately right. Probably the simplest way of viewing it.
And it can be a lot of different elements, right? Like I said.
Yeah.
I've just hammered this home, like I'm the language is complex thing. I had a conversation with Ernst Wendland. I don't know if you guys know him or.
Oh, yeah.
So we were talking in Israel about, you know, Micah and where I was giving a presentation on performs and whatever. And he just said, well, like, you know, the discourse features kind of override what the meaning of the verbs mean here, right? And it was just that we were just having this discussion. And I think this is, again, like kind of what people do within this field. It's like, okay, Ernst's thing is discourse, right? And, you know, kind of structure of discourse, trying to figure out units and that kind of thing. So that's good and important work. But that doesn't mean it, like whatever your field is will override whatever my field is, right? Again, it's just important to be able to do both of those things, right? And at the end of the day, and I think this is widely recognized within the field of semantics and pragmatics, the pragmatic meaning is going to be subordinate to the semantic meaning. So like the semantic meaning of like, can you pass this all, always going to be there, right? The pragmatic meaning may or may not be there, right? And it's going to depend on the context. In the context of eating dinner at a table where we're all adults, can you pass the salt? Pretty much always means give me the salt, right?
Yeah.
But if I'm talking to my 2-year-old, like, can you pass the salt? Oh, good job, right? I mean, that's a different meaning.
Right. Yeah.
And so the idea is that the use of these things in a particular discourse, right, might vary. But semantically, it's going to be very, very consistent across contexts.
Yeah. And there's certain sentences, certain parts of a text, especially an ancient text, where you're not going to know ultimately. I mean, you're just going to have to sort of leave it to, well, here's the best explanation that we can give. But unless this is a 2-year-old or not, then we don't know, then we can't give the correct answer, right?
Right. So. Right. Yeah. But it's helpful to think about, you know, again, how we use language and to see, like, honestly, and what you said earlier, Matthew, I think is a really important point, just that they weren't that different, right? They're humans. Mm-hmm. They're using language, right? Mm-hmm. It is, of course, there are in some ways, there are massive differences, right? But in a lot of other ways, they're using language just like we would. Right, and that's why I think it's actually really helpful to dive into linguistics, because you have modern languages that we can analyze, and then we can see how we're using language, and we can make hypotheses and test certain things about how we use language, and then we can say a reasonable guess in this context, like in Job, for example, where no one knows what's going on,
right?
But it is like let's use the tools that we have, right, to
try
out.
To understand, yeah.
Exactly, what's going on.
Yeah, it's good.
So what I hear you saying on the linguistic level, like you mentioned, this conversation you're having on Micah is still within linguistics. It's important to have a holistic perspective too, because everyone within linguistics has their specialty, but just because it's discourse doesn't mean the discourse always rules. It's all these things together, which is, it's kind of a plug for what Nathan and I care about doing within all of Hebrew Bible studies, which is trying to be holistic. I think it can be easy for us to say, I'm just a language person, or I'm just a text person, I'm just an archaeology person, I'm just a theology person. It's okay to specialize, but remember that we're a part of a greater conversation. And what I would encourage anyone listening to this, some people listening are really into language. Hopefully this inspires you to realize that language is even more of an epic journey than you thought. You know, there is a deep end to this pool. Go for it. Yeah. And to those of you listening that language is not your number one priority specialty, just know that there are, guess what? Even if linguistics is not your specialty, there are linguists like Kevin who would love to help you. And yeah, let's try to incorporate all this together instead of just, let me assume that what I have in my bag, so I'm using basketball NBA terms here, you know, how big is your bag? How many, you know, different skills do you have? But like, there's resources we have out there. And I think we shouldn't be intimidated by complexity. I think it should excite us to realize there's a wonderful adventure ahead of us. Let's figure this out one step at a time, one group at a time. So as we kind of conclude here, we want to make sure people get to hear about Biblingo, which is a resource that you have. And I hadn't used it for myself to learn biblical languages, but I decided to get on and just kind of test out some of the things. And it's very interesting. So why don't you go tell us about Biblingo and how people can get connected more with you and your content?
Yeah, I mean, as far as getting connected, you know, like you said, Biblical Languages Podcast, and then biblingo.org is our website. You can find, you know, all our resources. So Biblingo, basically, you know, the idea was I went to Israel, and that's really where I, you know, learned these languages to any like real degree. and you know, everyone's always learning a language. Like I'm still learning English. I'm really, like, you just, you're only learning vocabulary and stuff. At least you should be. But the idea was I studied at the Polis Institute, which is, you know, immersive Hebrew and Greek. And I recognized that there are a very, 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 or there is a very, very, very small percentage of people that will be able to do what I did, right? To go to Israel, spend years there taking these courses to learn to speak Hebrew and Greek. But there are a lot of people that really want to learn Hebrew and Greek in that sort of immersive kind of style. So basically, Biblingo is an attempt to bridge that gap, right? So we have, you know, we filmed about 2,500 like short videos that are paired with Hebrew and Greek sentences. And the idea is that you would learn the biblical languages in the biblical world as close as you possibly can, right? So, you know, again, you know, Moshe lakach et asal, or Ha'ish lakach et asal, right? You will see a man dressed up in, you know, ancient biblical clothes, taking an ancient biblical basket and an ancient biblical setting, right? So the idea is that what we want you to do is get to the point where when you are reading the text in Hebrew, you are not thinking about the English gloss in your lexicon, right? We want you to be thinking about what the biblical world was like that those words are describing, right? That's what we do in English. When we hear words, we are thinking about what that world is like that is being constructed, right, by the words. So that's why we're, you know, pairing these things with visual representations, so that we're trying to bypass English as much as possible. So that's kind of like, honestly, the tip of the iceberg on you know, what we do. But the other kind of big thing is we're trying to get you to read the text fluently. So the way we do that is, you know, just sort of taking you through from nothing, right? And building your vocabulary and your reading comprehension and your ability to produce very gradually until, you know, you are sort of intuitively, you know, reading. So we don't want you to be, we don't want you to have a lexicon open while you're reading the Hebrew Bible, right? Well, what we want you to do is be able to read the Hebrew Bible like you're reading an English Bible, right? Mm-hmm. And so the way you get there is you don't start with the biblical text because it's way too hard, right? So what we're trying to do is we provide these like short stories that are basically on your level And then that eventually turns into simplified biblical stories, and then biblical stories that allows you this sort of on-ramp into the biblical text that, you know, hopefully by the time you get there, you are reading it like a text and not, you know, going one word, you know, by one, just figuring out what those words mean.
Excellent. Yeah, I love the philosophical approach you guys have with that. It reminds me of C.S. Lewis wrote a letter about his experience learning Greek. And he talks about the idea that I forget which Greek words he used. I'm not a Greek person, but he mentions in his letter that when you're reading Greek, when you see this Greek word, there should be no English word ship intruding. And instead, the way only C.S. Lewis could, he describes this beautiful ship. He's like, that's what should be going through your mind. And I like how your resource helps people to do that. So we stay in the target language, not decoding back and forth and back and forth. It's fantastic. One quick other feature I'll just throw out that I enjoy tinkering with is how if you open up the Bible section, you can click on any word and just add it to a note card deck, which is fun because I'm just too lazy to want to make those right now. And it's just boring to me. And it's like, this would be a perfect way to say, hey, how do I keep learning more words? Because, okay, I have those high-end words now, those low-frequency words. As I run into it, click on it, add to a note card deck. It's already made for me, and I can go there later and check. A lot of features. Go on their website, check it out. I think whether you are anywhere from beginner to advanced, there's something for you that's worth considering this as an excellent resource that they've made. Do you have any final thoughts as we close out our interview with you?
Yeah, I guess just going back to what you said earlier, I really do think that specialization is, you know, a good thing. And at the same time, it does, like you said, it can make people just kind of view everything through their specialty, right? Their special glasses. And I would just make a plug for, you know, if you are out there, you want to do the languages, go for it. And now is a fantastic time. I mean, really, we have a ton of resources. You know, the field of linguistics is like, people that don't know the field are often intimidated by it, but there are huge strides that are being made in just our understanding of language in general. And we have more and more resources to learn these languages coming out all the time. So it is a fantastic time to learn the languages. And at the same time, if that's not your cup of tea, just encouraging people to be in dialogue, right? Both ways, right? I need the archaeologists, right? To tell me what in the world, an ohel referred to, because it's not the tent in my backyard, right? that I put up with my kids, right? And so that's an important part of learning language. I mean, when we talk about learning language, you have to learn the language and the culture. I think, you know, just the more kinds of conversations we can have that will wed those two together, I think the better for all of us.
I couldn't agree more. So thank you for sharing your specialty with us, and hope this gets people more excited about this field. Nathan, do you have any last words?
No, but fantastic. Thanks, Kevin, for sharing your expertise with us. And we encourage our listeners to go to BibLingo.
Thanks for joining us today.
Great. Thanks a lot for having me.